Astronomerica presents a spacewalk among the stars. We're going to stroll around in the constellation Monoceros tonight in search of the famous Rosette Nebula and take in some other sights along the way. Monoceros is one of the dimmer constellations, but pretty large. Monoceros is supposed to be a unicorn, but it looks more to me like a flying pterodactyl, with its head pointed down below Orion's feet, as if it were swooping down to scoop little Lepus the Hare out of the weeds. So let's make sure you have your telescope set up, the finder scope aligned using a bright star, or the go-to control ready to work, and your eyepieces at hand. Get comfortable and let's go. I'll be guiding you as if you didn't have any go-to or digital setting circles, but if you want to use them, feel free. But we'll be wandering around a bit. We'll start out at Epsilon Monoceratus, a star also known as 8 Monoceratus. To find Epsilon, a chart would be easiest, but let's try and find it without one. First, find the constellation Orion. Look at the bright 0.5 magnitude star in the upper left. If you're in the northern hemisphere, that's a little bit yellow or orange. That's Betelgeuse, or Alpha Orionis. It's a huge star, one of the largest known, in fact, termed a red supergiant. If you put it in place of the Sun, its surface would be out somewhere past the orbit of Mars. It's also 10,000 times as luminous as the Sun, and it's about 430 light-years away. It could explode as a supernova at any time. In fact, it may have done so already, and we wouldn't know it yet, being that it takes the light and radiation 430 or so years to get here. If it did go supernova, it might be somewhere between the full moon and the sun in brightness. The name is curious, and despite what some people will assert, because it's a corruption of Arabic and Latin along the way, there's really no definitively correct pronunciation. So if you like Betelgeuse, go for it. The star in Orion's opposite shoulder is Bellatrix, which means female warrior in Latin. And it's also designated Gamma Orionis, a 1.6 magnitude blue-white giant. Bellatrix is much hotter than Betelgeuse, but not as luminous, and only about 240 light-years away, perhaps 200 light-years closer than Betelgeuse. A small unseen companion star makes it an eruptive variable, and it does vary very slightly in magnitude. So anyway, take the distance between Bellatrix and Betelgeuse, and go towards the other side of Betelgeuse, the side opposite Bellatrix, and angle downward toward the horizon, if you're in the northern hemisphere, at about a 30-degree angle from a straight line from Bellatrix through Betelgeuse. The first naked eye star you come to is 4.5 magnitude Epsilon Monoceratus. It's here that we'll start tonight's journey. Epsilon is a nice double star. Aim at Epsilon with the finder scope. You know you'll have it because there's a curious tight grouping of dim stars within the field in the direction away from Orion and just near the edge of a typical finder scope field of view. We'll get back to that in a moment. Epsilon is a multiple star with a 4.4 magnitude yellow-white primary, a 6.5 magnitude secondary at position angle 027, and at about a 13 arcsecond separation. Although this double is a fixed binary, most binary stars do change position over time because of their orbits. So if you see a position angle and a separation listed, its orbit may have shifted one or both parameters considerably since it was cataloged. In fact, many sources quote data that it's way out of date, which I'm sure confuses other people besides me. If you're up for a real challenge this early in the walk and have a 10-inch or larger scope with a nice dark sky or correspondingly larger scope and not so dark sky, You might want to try for UGC 3459, which is a 14.7 magnitude spiral galaxy, only 8 arc minutes to the north-northeast of Epsilon. Using position angle to describe the direction, it would be 026 from Epsilon, with north being at 000. The whole position angle thing needs a little explaining. A circle is 360 degrees, so we give position angle as 000 for north and move counterclockwise with east at 090, south at 180, and west at 270. UGC stands for Uppsala General Catalog, a galaxy catalog published in 1973, which includes almost 13,000 galaxies smaller than 1 arc minute in diameter and brighter than 14.5 magnitude in the northern sky. It was compiled from blueprints of the Palomar Observatory Sky Survey and was presented to the Royal Society of Sciences in Uppsala, Sweden, in 1971, hence the name. At best, this galaxy, UGC 3459, will appear in the telescope as a very faint, fuzzy spot, if you even have a scope big enough to see it. I haven't even tried for it in my 10-inch, but you might, just for the fun or frustration of it, as the case may be. It lies just to the west of an 11.5 magnitude star. You'll have another 11.6 magnitude star just 2 arc minutes to the northwest of the first one, with the galaxy south-southeast of that second star and just west of the first one. If you do spot it, please go to Astronomerica on the web and shoot me an email. In fact, I'd like to hear about any observations you make using these spacewalks among the stars. Oddly enough, there's actually a rich galaxy cluster only about 2 degrees west of Bellatrix, Abel Galaxy Cluster 539. Not something you'd expect to be visible in the area so close to the galactic plane with all its star fields, nebulosity, and dust. There are actually quite a few galaxies in western Orion, most of them 14th magnitude and dimmer, however. If you're up for the UGC 3459 galaxy challenge, just pause the recording here because you'll need more time to look for it. Next, we'll move on to the Rosette Nebula, which is NGC 2237. It's 2 degrees and 10 minutes away from Epsilon Monoceratus in position angle 080, which is roughly east. The tight grouping of stars we saw in the finder scope is actually the cluster associated with the nebula. The cluster is NGC 2244. So the easiest way to go there is just to go back in the finder scope, find that little group, and aim at it. Try that now. It's a pretty scattered cluster. But if you look at it in the center, in the eyepiece, you'll start perhaps picking up some fainter stars. So it's a bit richer than it looks at first. So once you've got it in the finder scope, switch to your eyepiece and take a look. Now, the longer you look, the more you'll see. And there are actually around 100 fifth to tenth magnitude stars in the cluster. You can pause the recording here if you need to find it. The brightest star in there, on the southeastern end of a Gemini-like rectangular grouping of the brightest stars, is 12 Monoceratus, a yellow 5.9 magnitude star. This cluster is in the center donut hole of a huge nebula, the Rosette. So put in the very lowest power that you have, and if you have a nebula filter, put that in. Take out your binoculars, too. They're all good for observing this. Use your finder scope if you don't have binoculars. I found an effective trick was to hold my nebula filter in front of the finder eyepiece, and the nebulosity popped out as a diffuse halo. You may only be able to see a hint of it in the telescope eyepiece with your lowest power. On the side away from the brightest star, that's 12 Monoceratus, in that cluster, which is the opposite end of that thin rectangle of stars, or northwest of the cluster, is the brightest section of the nebulosity. I can see some of it in a semi-rural sky, but it doesn't make a clean donut and doesn't fit into the field at 50 power. Much better views can be had from a truly dark sky and with a nice wide field eyepiece. Big binoculars really work well on this. Well, while you're perusing the area, I'll tell you a little bit about it. The associated star cluster makes it easier for us to determine the Rosette's distance, which is about 5,000 light years away. It lies in the next spiral arm outward from our own arm in the Milky Way galaxy. We're in the Orion arm, and the Rosette is on the closer side of the Perseus arm. It's an emission nebula, glowing because the stars that actually formed starting only about 4 million years ago, and that are probably still forming from the nebula, are ionizing its atoms and causing them to glow. The radiation from the stars in the cluster have blown a relatively clear area in the center of the nebula that's perhaps 20 light years or so across. The nebula itself spans somewhere around 100 light years. If you have a dark sky, you'll see some of the dark lanes, coagulations, and shadings in the nebulosity. And especially with a nebula filter, you can spend a lot of time on the Rosette. If your sky is more light polluted and you don't have a filter or a smaller telescope, you might wonder what all the fuss is about. Well, like everything else, sky quality really makes all the difference. So if you're disappointed in the Rosette, you really need to get to a darker sky or get out on a more transparent night. But don't feel bad. When astronomers John Flamsteed in 1690 and William Herschel in 1784 independently discovered this star cluster, neither one of them detected the nebulosity. In fact, the first hint of the nebulosity wasn't discovered until Albert Marth, observing on the island of Malta in 1864, pointed his boss's 48-inch speculum telescope at the cluster. Now, Marth was a German astronomer who was also famous for discovering asteroid 29 Amphitrite and cataloging hundreds of nebulae. And he actually has craters on the Moon and Mars named after him, Albert Marth. Now, with the wide-field, short focal-length telescopes and nebula filters of today, even peons like you and me can observe this impressive nebula. So pause the recording here if you'd like to linger. This is the main show, after all. If you're done with the Rosette, we'll move on. If not, pause again and resume when you're ready. Next, we'll move northeastward to another open star cluster, NGC 2252. Which is 8th magnitude. It's a bit more than half a degree distant, about 44 arc minutes, in position angle 042, which is to the northeast of the Rosette. In my low power, which is around 50 power, it sits on the edge of the field when I put 12 Monoceratus on the opposite edge. It looks like a curl of faint stars, a bit reminiscent of a seahorse, or the constellation Scorpius in miniature, with the brightest star near the end of its curly tail. With north up, it looks even more seahorse-ish, with the bright star marking its eye. But we'll probably be looking at that upside down if we're in the northern hemisphere. It actually sits right on the edge of the Rosette's outer edge, as seen in deep images of the nebula. If you bump the power up to 150 or higher, there's a 9.8 magnitude double star with a very close companion in a north-south alignment about halfway up the body of the seahorse. Go ahead and pause the recording now. See if you can find that. It's about halfway up the body of the seahorse. Well, the primary of this double star is 9.8 magnitude. There's an 11.6 magnitude star 24 arc seconds to the west, but the closer companion I'm talking about is just north of the 9.8 magnitude star by perhaps 8 or 9 arc seconds in my estimation. See if you can see that. There's another more scattered batch of stars in a circular area just east of that, which is where the center of the cluster is usually plotted, and all these stars actually make up the cluster. Go ahead and pause here to take a longer look. Well, when I'm looking at these open clusters, oftentimes they kind of suggest patterns or pictures or images to me, and I thought of NGC 2252 as the wild goose cluster, because we already have a wild duck cluster, that's M11. In the constellation Scutum. So I call this one the Wild Goose Cluster, because if you take the seahorse asterism as one curvy wing and add the scattered stars to the east, it kind of forms something of a wiggly V or Y shape, with the brightest star in the seahorse forming the point. So being so wiggly, maybe we'll call it the Drunken Wild Goose Cluster. Maybe that's more appropriate. There's an observer from Finland who calls it a wind serpent, whatever that might be. But then maybe you see something entirely different, or even nothing at all. Which reminds me, do take a look up at the sky occasionally, because with your eye glued to the eyepiece, you may not notice that clouds have overtaken you. I've had this happen many times, when I couldn't figure out why a familiar object was so difficult to see. So moving east from the eastern edge of NGC 2252, moving eastward, about 12 arc minutes, there's a neat little tiny triangle of stars on the southern end of a faint chain of stars, which is oriented roughly north and south. Can you find that? Move east about 12 arc minutes. Well, this tiny triangle of stars is Struve 939. Multiple star system. Take a look at it. Go ahead, take a look at it. And while you're looking at it, let me explain something too. I was looking on the chart here in this area, and there's a couple of galaxies plotted nearby. And these are MCG 1173 and MCG 1174. These are supposedly 12.8 and 14.3 magnitude at about a position angle of 060, maybe 22 arc minutes away from Struve 939. Well, I was unable to locate these in my 10-inch, and looking at images later, I saw why. The first galaxy is actually a bit of reflection nebulosity around a star, and the second one doesn't exist at all. But there is an interesting thin dark dust lane visible in images cutting through that area. So do take a look at the many images available on the internet when you get home. But the lesson here is don't always believe your charts. So while you're looking at Struve 939, let's think about what we're going to look at next. Well, about 45 arc minutes to the north-northeast of Struve 939, this little cluster called Colander 106. It's a loose open cluster dominated by a blue-white sixth magnitude star on the northern end. While you're trying to find that, let me tell you a little bit about Colander clusters, and this one in particular. So you're moving about 45 arc minutes to the north-northeast of Struve 939. Well, the Colander catalog of 471 open clusters was put together by Swedish astronomer Dr. Per Colander and published in 1931. You'll see these listed on some detailed charts as CR and the number, or COL and the number. But besides studying star clusters, Dr. Colander spent a good deal of his career surveying the seas around Sweden and the Arctic, and he was also a historian of Swedish astronomy. Now, Colander clusters tend to be somewhat scattered and, in my opinion, underwhelming, but sometimes contain some interesting stars, as is the case here in Colander 106. That brightest star, the sixth magnitude star, is actually a spectroscopic binary system, one that we can't split visually. in which two very massive and hot blue-white supergiant stars are in a 14.4-day orbit around their common center of mass and separated by a mere 50 million miles, which is like having a star orbiting the sun between the orbits of Venus and Mercury, if the sun were the other component. That's really close for stars, and stars that massive. This system is known as Plaskett's star, after Canadian astronomer John Henry Plaskett, who discovered it was a binary in 1922. This is one of the most massive binaries known, with a combined mass almost 100 times that of the sun. The stars are rotating rapidly, and stellar winds are stripping material from them. Eventually, they'll both go supernova, which will be quite interesting to observe. And doesn't it look so peaceful there in your telescope? Well, I hate to say it, but Colander 106 marks the end of this spacewalk. I hope you've enjoyed your time out under the stars. Make sure you visit the Rosette again, preferably with a nice dark and transparent sky, a wide-field eyepiece, a nebula filter, and no job or class to have to go to the next morning, but always with a willingness to wander around and explore the neighborhood. As Yogi Berra said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.